In John 21, verse 25, at the end of the Apostle John's Gospel there, he made a very interesting statement. I'll just read it to you. He said, "There are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." That's a very interesting statement to ponder. Maybe you have. The concept of what a book looks like and feels like certainly has changed in the last couple of decades with e-readers and tablets and even cell phones that we use to now read books in the way that we used to physical books decades ago. But the thought is still the same here that John is expressing. What he is saying is that the life of Jesus Christ was filled with so many acts of service, of healing, of teaching, of so many other things, that it would be very challenging to record everything. And maybe you feel the same way. There are so many things that I would like to have known about his life. Even growing up as a boy, what was the family like? I know what it was like with my four brothers. I wonder if it was similar for him. What he felt like with his stepdad, working with him side by side, learning the trade. What did he feel or ponder when Joseph died? What did he do from age 12 to age 30? We have no record of any of that. We're left with wanting so much more that we would like to have had recorded for us. And I think that's also part of John's point. As Jesus Christ approached what would be the last year of his physical life, he spent more time in the area of Judea and Jerusalem specifically. Prior to that time, he had not. And he did so deliberately, because if he had spent time in Judea and Jerusalem, it would have more directly stirred up, if you will, the anger of the Sadducees and the Pharisees before it was time. Because he knew once that took place, it would be a short step to them killing him. They had become so rigid, the Sadducees and the Pharisees had become so rigid in what they thought God expected in worshiping him, that they couldn't or wouldn't see the Messiah literally right in front of them. Rather than seeing and considering what they had made in terms of the letter of the law and the importance of that, rather than the spirit of the law, they saw Jesus Christ as a threat. They saw him as a threat to their authority, their teaching. They saw him even as a potential problem with their relationship with the Roman authorities. But Jesus saw in the Sadducees and Pharisees a spirit that openly opposed what God actually valued. In the sermon this afternoon, we're going to consider one statement in particular that Jesus Christ said a couple of times in his ministry that's important for us to consider this week. The title of my sermon today is simply "The Leaven of the Pharisees." Let's begin, if you will, with me in Matthew 16, where he makes this statement. Matthew 16 and in verse 6. I'll back up and give the context here in just a moment, but to read verse 6, it says, "Jesus said to them," that is the disciples, he said, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." The Greek word here translated leaven means to ferment or leaven. We don't think of fermentation often, or leavening rather, oftentimes as fermentation, but even as we heard in the sermonette, that whole process produces a gas. That's what the puffing up comes from. In the case of bread, then it makes it expand. But why did Jesus say this statement here? It almost seems like an offhand comment when you go back and look at some of the context. Jesus had just fed a multitude of 4,000 people. And the Pharisees and Sadducees had challenged Jesus once again for a sign. Now, the sign was not looking for something, as he did oftentimes, a healing, a removal of a demonic spirit, or things of this nature. They wanted something specifically from heaven they would recognize directly from God. You could make an argument, all of those things showed that, but they had such a rigid thing in their mind, they couldn't see anything else. Consequently, to those conversations, then the disciples and Jesus traveled across the Sea of Galilee, actually kind of downward along the coast, and when they arrived in Bethsaida, this is when he makes this statement. The disciples missed the meaning of what he was saying, but even the Sadducees and Pharisees didn't understand what Christ was saying in a broader context. So to continue here in verse 7, it says, "When they had reasoned among themselves," the disciples, They're saying to themselves, what is he talking about? Leaven with Pharisees. Did we forget something? Oh, we didn't bring bread. He's talking about bread. How is it after Christ just miraculously fed 4,000 people, that's what they came to? They didn't need bread. Bread's not the point. Christ could turn enough food out of scraps into enough to feed 4,000 people. So he wasn't talking about bread here. So to continue in verse 8, he's aware of what they're saying. He understands, but he sort of chides them. He says, oh, you of little faith, why do you reason amongst yourselves that I said this because you brought no bread? And then he goes back. He says, did you not understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? This was even prior to feeding the 4,000. He says, don't you remember that? They were all hungry. It was late. There was no way they could get anywhere to get enough food to purchase. They would have been hungry, and it was late in the day. He said, we took those few bits of food, and I blessed them and multiplied it. He said, don't you remember that? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets they took up. So again, if you go back to the Greek and look at those sections, a basket was talking about something like a hamper, not like something you collect a small amount in. There was quite a bit left over, even beyond what they ate. He says, how do you not remember that? Verse 11, how is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread? Which, well, seems like rather a logical thing, though, looking at it from a human perspective, doesn't it? He says, rather, but to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We're still not quite there, are we? Because they're still thinking, okay, well, you're still talking about leaven, which is usually involved in bread, and you're talking about it being connected to the Pharisees and Sadducees, but they're still probably not getting it at this point, because the question I would ask if I was there is, then what is the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees? Well, to answer that question, we need to move forward about 6 months in time from this statement and go to Luke chapter 12. I don't know that he left them hanging. Maybe he explained it, but maybe it wasn't recorded until Luke recorded it as to what Christ was actually talking about. So in Luke 12 and verse 1, it says, in the meantime, as these previous things had played out, he had tried to correct the Pharisees and the scribes, who were known also as the lawyers. They were trying to trap him in these mind games they were doing, these questions they thought would show that he didn't have the authority or the understanding or whatever it happened to be. So it says, in the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples first, before directing his comments to the group, he talks to his disciples first and he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is what we read back in Matthew 16. But now he explains what that is, which is hypocrisy. The Greek word here for hypocrisy means to be acting under a feigned part. We would connect that to actors. This is how it was used in the context of this time period, because it also involved deceit. Actors deceive, don't they? They pretend to be something they're not. And this is where we get the word hypocrisy from. Someone pretending to be something they're not, or thinking they're something they're not. It also involves condemnation, which is judging improperly, isn't it? So in the context, again, of the Greek world at the time, these actors would wear masks, literally. They had masks that they would wear at times. And those masks usually represented something or someone. They would also perhaps dress the part, much like they do today in the movies and the entertainment of that sort that we have today. So what Christ is saying here is the Pharisees and Sadducees are just a bunch of actors. This is not who they are, who they think they are. They were religious leaders pretending to obey God. They put on a show of religion, like an actor putting on a mask or a costume. Their example was actually corruptive and destructive, wasn't it? And much like leavening, once that's there, it's virtually impossible to remove it. How do you take leavening out of bread that's been leavened? You can't. But notice what Jesus goes on to say here in verse 2. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you have spoken in the ear, in the inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. That's quite scary if you think about it. What it's saying is, eventually, who you are and what you are will be revealed. It's not even necessarily specifics, although we should be careful with our words there as well. But over time, we show who we are, even if we're pretending we're something else. The modern English definition of hypocrisy is this: the practice of claiming to have moral standards or beliefs to which one's own behavior does not conform. Pretense. Part of why Jesus made the statement he did here about the leaven of the Pharisees is that, as I said, eventually all behavior of the heart will be revealed. The hypocrite never believes that others will see him or her for who they are, because they believe it so much themselves oftentimes. This is the trouble with trying to argue with someone who is a compulsive liar. They believe their own lies. You will never convince them otherwise. This is the reality they have in their head. But a couple of years ago, when I was putting this together, I was remembering this account. I was part of a conversation where one individual became very aggressive and condemning in his comments to the group that I was a part of there. One of the other members of this conversation later tried to defend the one who was speaking out and being so disrespectful and acting wrongly. He said of this individual, he said, "You don't understand. He felt pushed into a corner and lashed out in frustration." And I replied, "No, you don't understand. It's in those moments that we truly reveal who we are. Something previously covered was now revealed. I saw that person in a way I'd never seen them before." Hypocrisy is always eventually revealed, because it is not an attribute of God. Are we pretending in our Christian walk? This is why I said this is very scary on one level, verses 2 and 3 here, to consider, because nobody wants to be exposed, right? Nobody wants to be embarrassed. No one wants to have acts or words or whatever called out, because we feel vulnerable. But on the other hand, we're here on this week, these days of unleavened bread. Use the symbol of leaven, the type of leaven, as a puffing up, as a symbol of sin, and how that can puff us up, as we've heard in various messages here recently. But at the core of what this week is about, it's about us becoming unleavened. The puffing up that happens within us with sin. Because who is the one that we deceive the most? It's ourselves. We say all the time, doesn't matter, no one will know, in the scheme of things, this is okay. We justify things all the time, don't we? We pretend it's okay. But let's go back and look at some examples in Matthew 6 of what the Pharisees and the Sadducees did in their behavior and why Christ lamented over this so much. They were unrepentant when he would call them out. And here's the really tough thing. It's usually the people we don't like who will say these things. Right? They'll call us out. And rather than hear the words, we look at the person. And we dismiss it because we don't like them. And we don't stop to think, what if they're right? In Matthew 6 and verse 1, this is all part of the what's called Sermon on the Mount. Mr. Barnett touched on this last week on the Sabbath, but he's continuing this whole thought from 5, 6, and 7. So in Matthew 6 and verse 1, he says, "Take heed," speaking to the multitudes there, "that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father." From God's perspective, the whole point of charitable deeds is to affect two people. the one giving and the one receiving. And they both receive a blessing from God because it is about the relationship, isn't it? It's about serving. When we make sure everyone knows what we're doing, like the Pharisees did, then that takes away from the charitable deed, doesn't it? Now it becomes something of vanity almost. We see this in politicians and business leaders and entertainers especially. They'll talk about their foundation. They'll talk about the things they've done because it pulls attention to them in other ways. To continue here in verse 2, it says, "Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues." We're back to that word. They're pretending something. Come back to a thought here in a second. They do this in the synagogues, in the streets. Notice why, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. There's some archaeological evidence that's been discovered over the last couple of decades that around the temple complex, there were different receptacles for donations that would be made. It could be made to widows and orphans. It could be made to the temple itself and so forth. But the way these receptacles were designed is that when you put money in it, it made the most noise possible before it fell on the bottom. Shaped sort of like a trumpet so that it would make this noise and sort of broadcast it. It's not something you could do in secret. You couldn't just walk by and casually drop some coins in there. When you did it, everybody knew. They would look, oh, so-and-so is putting some money in the receptacle. This is what he's talking about here. Verse 3, "But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing," which is impossible, isn't it? It's hyperbole. It's exaggeration for the effect that it is such a quiet thing that one part of your existence doesn't know the other part is doing it. Notice why, verse 4, "That your charitable deed may be done in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly." If we're not careful, we can do our charitable deeds to be seen as the Pharisees did. And their reward, in verse 2, says that their reward was the recognition of men. How long does that last? As long as those men like us. But our desire should be to please God, as we read in verse 4. He is the rewarder of these actions because he sees the heart in these things. Verse 5, then, to continue, he goes through this model prayer because the disciples themselves didn't even know how to pray without drawing attention to themselves. We have the example that's recorded in the other places in the gospel about the Pharisee and the tax collector. Did it ever strike you that they're saying these prayers publicly, out loud? You know, the tax collector was hated amongst the people, mostly because they collected taxes, right? Nobody likes to pay taxes. But the problem with the tax collectors is they pretty much were given a free hand by the Roman authorities. They didn't care what other money they collected as long as Rome got their slice. So oftentimes they would make up things to get more money. And then even beyond that, they weren't liked because they were agents of Rome. They were fellow citizens, but they worked for Rome, doing their bidding. And so tax collectors were hated. And you remember what that tax collector said? "You shouldn't even hear my prayer. Who am I?" And the Pharisee says, "I'm a really good guy compared to this guy." This is what is being talked about here. In verse 5, it says, "When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners that they may be seen by men." And he says, and that's their reward. Their reward is to be seen. Which, if I follow the thought along, means God's not hearing them. Because if their reward is to be heard by men and they receive that, then there's nothing left, is there, beyond that. In verse 7, he says to pray with sincerity. Don't use vain repetition, for they think they will be heard of their many words. I'm not looking for a show of hands, but do you know anybody like that? You ever try to have a conversation with somebody like that? They think if they just talk over everybody, that everybody will just listen to what they have to say and believe them. Well, do we do that with God? Do we just kind of beat the drum with the same thing over and over again until, as a parent would, they get tired and say, "Okay, just be quiet. It's not what God is seeking. Verse 14, to move down, at the end of this model prayer here, he says, "For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you." And the Pharisees certainly were not known for being forgiving or merciful or long-suffering. What was their reaction when Christ healed the young man who had been blind from birth? Their reaction was, "He's an awful man because he did this on the Sabbath." That one, those always struck me, but if you want to do an interesting study, go through the Gospels and notice how many times Christ healed on the Sabbath day. And almost every time the Pharisees and or Sadducees took him to task for it. Do you know why? That was one of their list of prohibitions because it was considered work. Right? You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. That was considered work if you helped heal somebody. You would think that day of all days would be the most important day for that to be done, to be released on God's holy day, His Sabbath day. And yet they failed to see all of this. That blind man was kicked out of the synagogue. And he goes back and he finds Christ. And Christ asked him, you know, basically, "How you doing?" He says, "Well, I was kicked out of the church." And Christ blessed him. Verse 16, if we move down a little bit more. "Moreover, when you fast," so he moved from praying to fasting now, and he says, "When you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance." Now, it's kind of hard, isn't it? When you have no food in your belly, and you haven't had for some time, you don't have the same energy. This is not what he's talking about here. He says, "For they disfigure their faces. They deliberately make it look like they're fasting, that they may appear to men to be fasting." Now, that wording is very interesting because it almost gives the impression that they may not have been. Because if they're hypocrites, the next step is just to act like you're doing these things. He says, "Assuredly, I say to them, they will have their reward," which is to be seen again, for others to be impressed with their spirituality. Are you kidding me? He's fasting again. He just told me 2 days ago he was fasting. How does he do this? Verses 19 through 21, Christ talks about a perspective here in light of all that's been covered so far. He said, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moss and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth or rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal." Verse 21, "For where your treasure is, there will be your heart." The leadership as well during this time, unfortunately, had become wealthy off the backs of the common people. They desired wealth, power, and recognition. Do you remember the example of when Christ drove out the animals from the temple area? The ones that owned the animals went with them. That was the point. But he drove them out. Do you know why? First of all, they shouldn't have been doing business in that area. That was not the place for it. There were areas outside the temple complex this could have been done. But what they were actually doing is making merchandise of the people. Because if they came in from somewhere outside of Roman Palestine, they wouldn't have the Roman shekel, which is what they would only take at the temple. You could have any other coinage, right? Silver is silver, gold is gold, whatever. They would not accept it, which meant they had to exchange the money. What happens when you exchange money? It's always a fee, right? You're not doing this out of generosity of your heart. But they would also look at their offerings. They would bring this young sheep or ram or whatever it was to make their offerings, and the priests would look at them and say, "No, you can't use that one. It's got a blemish on it. It's not the right age," or whatever. "I just so happen to have some you can buy from me." And they would make money as well there. This is what they were doing. This was the treasure they had. How long does that treasure last? The old saying about he who dies with the most toys wins? No, he who dies with the most toys still dies, doesn't he? We spend a lifetime accumulating things that go to other people when we die. What type of treasure do we seek? If we don't have or seek to not have the leavening of the Pharisees, what type of treasure do we seek? It has to be outside of this world. Christ says, seek the treasure where moth doesn't corrupt and rust doesn't degrade. Even the interaction the Pharisees had with Jesus was hypocritical. Let's go back to chapter 22, Matthew 22. Once again, they're trying to trap him. They think they can pin him here on the matter of paying taxes. Because if they ask the question, who do we pay taxes to? And he says, not to Rome, only to the temple. They can say to the Roman authorities, this man's an insurrectionist. Right? He's promoting rebellion. If he says to the Roman authorities, then they can go to the people and say, this man is dismissing God. He's a secularist. He's supporting Rome. So they thought they had him pinned here. So Matthew 22 and verse 15, notice they went and plotted how they might entangle him. They did not go seeking understanding, insight, or anything of that nature. Verse 16, so they sent to him a disciple of the Herodians. These were more secularists. They supported Roman authority and so forth, saying, teacher, we know that you are true, teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. You think that's sincere? What kind of mask do you think that person had on to say that with a straight face? They didn't believe any of this. This is what we call flattery. They're thinking if they kind of butter him up, set him up, his guard's going to be down, they can catch him with something here. So verse 17, this is the question. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And notice what Christ did here. Jesus perceived their wickedness, their hypocrisy. Because they did both, didn't they? Everyone knew you do both. So he says, why do you test me, you hypocrites? By this time, Christ is not avoiding them because he didn't want to have the conversation. He avoided them because he knew when he became very direct like this, they were going to get beyond angry. Because how do you continue listening to someone, even if you know you're playing an angle here, and the response back is, you're just a big hypocrite. I don't care how nicely you say that, that's going to hurt. So he answers, whose image is on the coin? And then the classic line he tells them, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. But they weren't there to learn a deeper understanding of Scripture. They weren't there to be instructed. They were there to try to trap him. They had malicious intent. Let's continue this thought then in 1 Corinthians 5. We read this during the sermonette time period, and it's very fitting, as was mentioned to us all. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8, he says, therefore, let us keep the feast not with old leaven, nor with leaven of malice and wickedness. This is what Christ was talking about in terms of the leaven of the Pharisees. Their leaven was malice and wickedness, and when that puffs something up, it's very dangerous spiritually. Because if you have malice, how are you going to treat people? Not kindly, not with love, not with deference. You're going to hurt them. Wickedness, violating the law, doing whatever is immoral that you feel is your right. Paul continues in the thought here, but says, rather with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. This is not literal bread, is it? This is talking to us in the spiritual context. Bread is the object lesson. It's the physical thing we can point to understand a spiritual principle. When we leaven with sin, what do we get? We get hypocrisy before God. That's what he's seeking for us to understand here. This statement of sincerity and truth goes directly back to what Jesus Christ said in John 4:24. How do we worship God? Sincerity and truth, without hypocrisy, according to his law. Let's go back to Mark chapter 7, look at some more of this hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And again, I'm highlighting their example for us to consider so we don't follow what they say and what they do. Because again, it's very easy for us to justify ourselves. It's easy for us to do without thinking, and we can end up hurting others and even ourselves. In Mark 7, verse 1, it says, "The Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem." So he wasn't in that area. They specifically came to test him. "And they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defilement," that is, with unwashed hands, "and they found fault." Now, understand as well that in the context of this time period, first century, many aspects of what we would call Judaism were already in place. Right? It started after the coming out of the Babylon captivity. It accelerated specifically, though, around the time of the Maccabees and to the point where they had many of these things in place. They're not talking about these guys not having basic hygiene, right? You're working in the yard, you're working on a car, you're doing whatever, even preparing food. You want to make sure you wash your hands so the next thing you do, you're not cross-contaminating things. That's not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about is they had a full ritual, a process they had to do. To wash hands was not simply to have some running water and even maybe some soap. It was the hands a certain way. It was the forearms a certain way. It was the elbows up to the upper arm. There was a process that was expected, and it, again, was done publicly. So, they're upset. Verse 3, "The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands," notice, "in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders." What traditions do we have? Traditions are not bad. Traditions actually are pretty good. Traditions can help create a commonality in a family or a group. They can remind us of principles and things of importance. So it's not that traditions are bad, but when traditions trump truth, then they're bad. The traditions of the elders in this case trump truth, because what became more important was not the heart, not how they interacted with people, not how they taught the truth of God, but whether or not they washed their arms and their hands in a certain way. So it explains in verse 4, "When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they perceive and hold, like the washing of cups and pitchers and copper vessels and couches." This is an allusion in future type to what is now commonly called kosher. In an Orthodox Jewish home, you have two kitchens. You do not mix the utensils, the pots, the pans, anything in those kitchens. One side's meat, one side's dairy. And if you ever mix them, they become unclean. There's a whole process you have to go now to make them clean before you can use them again. Okay, where do they get this? It's their traditions. We have to be careful we don't have our own traditions that trumps God's truth. What is it that God wants us to understand this week? That we're sinful if we eat bread? Nope, that's not the point. It's a reminder of how easy it is to sin. We get in habits, don't we? One year I did that. I stopped at McDonald's. I wanted a sandwich. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to have a fish sandwich. I won't eat the bread. You're eating the last piece, and it's like, oh, wait a minute. Nope, failed that one. But it's easy, isn't it? When we're not thinking especially, it's really easy. And we notice in the process of de-leavening our homes, our cars, if possible, where we work, all these sort of things, how in the world do crumbs get in all those places? Right? But it does. This shows how easy it permeates everything, even the crumbs. So verse 5, they ask, the scribes and the Pharisees ask Christ, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of elders?" They didn't ask, why are they doing this and is it okay? Verse 6, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. As it is written, the people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." There is one of the important aspects. We can de-leaven our home, our cars. We can de-leaven our desk at work and go through these things. We could dry clean every bit of clothing we have. We can throw out the toaster to not even bother cleaning it. We can do all those things, but does that change our heart? Are we honoring God with our lips, and yet our heart is not even close? If we're not careful, those traditions become righteousness, don't they? I mean, when I was a boy, we would take the back seat. You could still do that. They had clips. You could take the whole back seat out. You'd get underneath there. You'd pull the spare tire out like we're carrying bread in the wheel well. But, you know, it's like you go through all these things. My mom would deep clean every bit of the house. Every window was open. Every piece of clothing got washed. The whole business. As an exercise, that can be insightful. How much time did it take to do that? Do we put that much time into asking God to help us be de-leavened? There's a balance in these things. We can't say it doesn't matter, because it does matter. God wants us to go through these object lessons for the very fact that the physical shows us something. To continue in verse 7, he says, "In vain they worship me." How many times did Israel say, "Well, we've brought you offerings. Look at the temple. Look at the things we've done. We keep your Sabbath," all these, and yet they didn't keep any bit of the law. They would also worship other gods. All of this compromise. Notice also, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. How can a body of men who claim to be the most righteous observers of the law of God create traditions that nullify the law of God and still claim to be righteous? It's oftentimes very easy to see the problem in the other person, though, isn't it? And not see it in ourselves. And we're back to the meaning of hypocrisy. If something really bothers us, as a brother, sister in Christ, we can have those conversations. But before we have those conversations, we need to make sure that we're not as equally offensive in the same thing or something different. That we come with a soft touch, knowing that we're equally guilty in whatever it is we see that should be done better. The deceitfulness of the nation of Israel anciently was a trait that God regularly condemned. They were going through the motions. They even worshipped Tammuz from the steps of the temple looking east across the Kidron Valley. And this is okay, because we're at the temple. We're here on this Sabbath day in this hall. But are we doing other things in our mind? Our focus somewhere else? The rest of the week, nobody knows what we do, mostly. We can come here and pretend if we're not careful. So how do we make sure that we're not taking of the leaven of the Pharisees? Let's go back to Matthew 23. Because Christ gives a very important principle here. Matthew 23 and verse 1. This whole chapter, if you want to afterwards, count up the number of woes and what Christ is condemning them on. A woe is not kind of a, this is really sad sort of thing. It is an exclamation of condemnation. So he says in verse 2, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." Now there's been a lot of speculation as to what that was. And pretty much the consensus is at this point is that within the synagogues, they would have, even to this day, they have a section, a chair, if you will, and sometimes it's behind a railing, and whoever was called on, whatever man of the congregation was called on to read from Scripture, that's where they would do it. And so what Christ is saying, if that is the case, when they're reading from the law, verse 3, "Whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do." When they're reading from the law. But he says, "Do not do according to their works, for they say and they do not do," which is what? Hypocrisy. If I stand up here and tell everyone that listens, everyone that watches a recording, everyone that might read my notes or whatever it happens to be, if I say God condemns this and then I go do it, what does that do for my credibility? It goes through the floor. Hypocrisy is one of those things that almost universally we hate more than anything else. not just because someone's not doing what they're saying, but because oftentimes, going back to the earlier part, as I mentioned, there's deceit involved. Let's go to verse 4. Let's continue there. So he says, again, he sent out other servants, saying, tell those who are... I'm sorry, in the wrong chapter. Verse 23. For they bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay on them men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. So these two sections are connected, but these two points here are essentially that we need to live the life. How do we not have the leaven of the Pharisees? We have to live the life. They didn't live the life. In James 1, well, let's just turn there, but hold your place here, and Matthew, we'll be back. But in James 1, James talks about this as well, this matter of not being a hypocrite. But he puts it in a little different context because he's highlighting it a little differently. So James 1 and verse 22, he said, but be doers of the word and not hearers only. Right? We have to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. It's easy to talk the talk. And especially if we have more authority or a title or recognition or whatever, we often think we're above people. This is the human way of governing, as opposed to remembering we're one of them. We're just like everybody else. Because notice, if we're not doers and only hearers, he says we deceive ourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. He observes himself and he goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he is. Right? We get ready for church. We put on our clothes, we brush our hair, we brush our teeth, whatever our routine is, we look in the mirror, yep, I'm good to go. We walk out, we get here and the wind is 20 miles an hour, our hair's all over the place, and maybe our collar's turned up, and we're not seeing any of that because we can't see it. We think we still look like we looked in the mirror. Well, spiritually, do we do the same thing? Verse 24, for he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. Now, the amazingly beautiful and merciful thing about God is he does not look at us as we are. He looks at us as what we will be. Through the sacrifice of his son, through our commitment to the process and being engaged, he looks at us not only as we will be, but that's the way he interacts with us. Let's go back to Matthew 23 and pick up in verse 5. Christ continues, he says, but they made light of it. I'm sorry, I'm still in the wrong chapter. I need to turn the page. Get away from there. All right, so verse 5. But all their works they do to be seen by men. We covered this earlier. They make phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. Now, what was the whole point of those two items? If you go back in the Pentateuch, there's instruction about having the fringe on the garments. And a phylactery was a little box, and those were both to be reminders, right? Maybe we do this. I've known people who have carried a coin in their pocket. Well, people that go through AA will often do this, right? They'll carry the coin, and when they touch it, they remind themselves what they need to stay away from, what they need to move towards. People will do this all the time. They'll wear a ring that their mom or dad had, you know, things of this nature. Well, spiritually, if we're not careful, we can make those things idols. They thought if they made that phylactery a little larger, and then somebody sees that and he says, I know that guy, that's not right. Mine's got to be larger. They just make these things bigger and bigger and bigger, thinking, well, that makes me better. No. So they loved the best places of the feast, the seats in the synagogues. They wanted to be seen. They had to be seen. Their identity was tied up in this. Verse 7, greetings in the marketplace and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. The title was important. Have you ever met anybody? The old joke is, how do you know if somebody went to MIT? The answer is, don't worry, they'll tell you. There can be an arrogance sometimes. Well, I went to Harvard. I went to MIT. I went to wherever. It's like, okay, well, Do you know anything, or is it just that? Do we do that? Well, I've been baptized 40 years. Okay, well, if you're living the life, great for you. If you're not, you just wasted 40 years. So we can't judge by outward appearances either. Because it was all about them. The hypocrisy they had was all about the physical appearance. Looking like I was fasting. Being heard when I gave alms. Making sure they saw my phylacteries and the fringe of my garments and where I sat and all of these things. Let's go back to chapter 7. Matthew 7. The beginning of this chapter is oftentimes misunderstood by not only Christians, but secular people. They will turn to this and they'll condemn Christians and say, as it says in verse 7, or verse 1 here of chapter 7, judge not that you be not judged. See, you're not supposed to judge me. That's not what this section is talking about at all. It's going back to the hypocrisy that we've been talking about, that Christ says, if you judge, you have to live up to the standard. So what we're talking about in this section is to not excuse ourselves. We make sure we don't have the leaven of the Pharisees when we don't excuse ourselves. I'll come back to that a little bit more, but let's continue here in verse 2. Notice, with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. So if I condemn sin, whatever it is, if I'm sinning, then I'm hypocritical, aren't I? If I'm doing the very same things I'm condemning someone of. That doesn't mean I can't judge it. I just have to have the same standard I'm holding them to. And this is the value that we can have as a body. That I could go to someone quietly. This is the charitable deeds, isn't it? We don't have to broadcast it to the whole church. If we recognize someone in someone else, probably because it's something we have to be careful with, we can go to them privately and say, can we talk? I can see some things you're struggling with, and I bring it up because I know where you are. Either I'm still struggling with it, or there's something I struggle with. Here's how God helped me. Can I help? Can I be a help? That's judgment on a whole different level, isn't it? This is what he's talking about, because he says, whatever judgment we judge with will be measured back to you. Verse 3. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank in your own? This is more hyperbole, exaggeration for effect. How would you not know there's a plank in your eye? Because I don't want to admit it's there. But a little speck, I mean, you get a grain of something or a hair off your eyelid in your eye, it hurts like crazy, doesn't it? Like somebody's taking steel wool across your eye. You stop everything until you can tease that out, whatever it is, and you look at it and it's like, seriously, that little thing? And we'll do that, but we've got a plank and we're condemning somebody else for a speck. This is the hyperbole here, the exaggeration. Why do you not look at the speck in your own eye? Rather, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, there is a plank in your own? To not excuse ourselves. Because he says in verse 5, hypocrite. It's another good study if you want to do it one of the rest of the days of this week. Just notice how many times Christ used that word. Read the context of what he's covering. He says, first remove the plank from your own eye. So if we're going to judge a matter, we have to first address ourselves. First remove the plank from your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. In emergency situations, almost everybody will tell you, make sure you're safe first, then help other people. Because you're no good if you contribute to the chaos. More people are going to get hurt. Spiritually, do we address ourselves before we address someone else? This is called foolishness in the Proverbs. You can go back and read through the Proverbs. One such section, if you want to write it down, is Proverbs 26:2, where it talks about a fool being wise in his own eyes. Right? A fool is no different than a hypocrite. You can't tell them anything. You can't teach them. You can't help them because they know everything. go next to Romans chapter 12. Another aspect of not having the leaven of the Pharisees is to be humble, which we've touched on in principle in many of the things that we've covered today. But in Romans 12 and verse 3, Paul talks about us being a living sacrifice here at the beginning of the chapter. And then in verse 3, he says, "For I say, through the grace given to me, that everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly." Now, that's not to say you can't recognize what your talents and abilities are. But we have to also recognize where those talents and abilities come from and how we are to use them to serve others. Rather than saying, because I have this, I'm better than you. That's thinking more highly of yourself. To continue on, he says, but to think soberly, humbly, to consider, as God has dealt with each one of you, a measure of faith. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter 5 and verse 6, Peter says this, "Therefore, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God." The whole section here, the middle part of this chapter, Paul's talking about this submission, this humility that we're to have with each other and towards God. You know, when Mr. Helwig started his sermonette, I'm thinking to myself, I'm pretty sure who he's talking about, but you could pretty much say that about any world leader. There's just something about having power and being recognized on that level, having whatever title. Humanly, it's not healthy because we begin to believe our own press, don't we? Well, I must be the best and the brightest. Everybody's telling me that. So 1 Peter 5, verse 6, then, "Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time." Because when we humble ourselves before God, when we ask him to help us become unleavened, then he knows what we're going to do when he gives us power. When he gives us eternal life, he'll know what we're going to do with it. And it's not going to be selfish. It's not going to be used hypocritically. Additionally, things I would consider, recommend that we do to not become or partake of the leaven of the Pharisees was to not lie, to be honest in our conversations. We even have that reassurance from Scripture, don't we, that it says that God who cannot lie, what would we do if God was a deceitful God? We wouldn't know what to believe, would we? And as I like to highlight when I bring up this matter of being honest and dependable, even the most corrupt thief wants an honest bookkeeper. Right? Nobody appreciates being lied to, especially when it comes to money. Be truthful, be honest, be sincere. That word sincere is really interesting. Look that up sometime. I won't give you the answer. But the meaning of that word is very interesting. Another item I would add is to seek and embrace God's truth. This is the humble nature we've talked about and covered in so many of these scriptures, to be submissive to God's instruction, to be humble and serving one another. That's God's truth, because that's who he is. Let's look at one last verse in Job chapter 20. God led Job through a very trying time, didn't he? One day Job wakes up, and as some will say, life is good. God is good. He had great wealth. He had thousands of servants. He had a family that loved each other. They loved spending time with each other. Everything about Job's life seemed to be really good, on the right track, doing the right things. And then the next day, everything changed, didn't it? Literally, everything changed. He lost all but one of his servants. All of his flocks were stolen. His whole family, except his wife and himself, were killed. In one day, everything's wiped away. What would you think? Job was in deep depression, and his supposed three friends show up, and initially they're kind of supportive, but then they start piling on, don't they? And it's not that they were incorrect. That's the problem reading through this, to kind of dissect this. On some points, they were right on. But what they accused Job of was so wrong. They had no basis for any of those things. And it became weary. And this is when Job started trying to defend himself, which is probably what all of us would do. I haven't done those things. Why are you accusing me of those things? There's a very interesting point here in this regard. In Job 20, verse 5. This is Zophar's sermon, if you will. He says, "The triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment." Now, they were condemning Job in this regard, but the point is very interesting. If we live a hypocritical life, what is it we gain? As Christ said about the Pharisees, the recognition they get from men is all they get. And that's fleeting, isn't it? At best, it's this lifetime, and then what? The hypocrisy that Christ was talking about is something we need to deeply consider, especially this time of year, because the theme is being de-leavened, isn't it? The theme is not bread. That's the vehicle. That's the lesson. That's the example that we can relate to. But we can't come out of sin if we're hypocrites. Whatever it is in our lives, we must be men and women of integrity, true integrity. What we say, we do. We back it up with our actions because we must reflect the fruit of God's Spirit. Let's ponder that for the balance of this coming week until Monday, especially, but let's never forget it as we move forward. May we always beware of the leaven of the Pharisees.